Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, April 14th, 2022. President Biden says he is looking into sending a top U.S. official to Ukraine to show solidarity in Ukraine's war with Russia. Russian state media saying that a Russian warship in the Black Sea has sunk. Ukraine claims it was hit by their missiles. Russia saying it was an ammunition explosion. A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers making a surprise visit to Taiwan, showing support for that island nation, which China does not recognize as independent from China. China's foreign ministry warning the U.S. lawmakers, senators, and House members against going down the wrong and dangerous path. President Biden in North Carolina at the Agriculture and Technical State University in Greensboro. He's pushing Congress to pass a bill known as the COMPETES Act. Stands for creating opportunities for manufacturing preeminence in technology and economic strength. And in campaign 2024 news, the Democratic National Committee making a big rules change on which states will be going first, second, and third in the presidential primaries and caucus list. The four that used to be guaranteed the top spots no longer are: Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. We'll talk about what this means with the chief political reporter at the Des Moines Register. This from CNN. President Joe Biden said Thursday he was still working with his team to determine whether he should dispatch a senior member of his administration to Ukraine, a potentially dramatic show of support for the nation as it comes under attack from Russia. Since Russian forces withdrew from the region surrounding Kyiv, a number of Western leaders have made their way to the Ukrainian capital to demonstrate support. While Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are unlikely to visit Kyiv themselves anytime soon, officials have discussed sending Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin or Secretary of State Antony Blinken. That from CNN. President Biden got a question about this as he flew out of Joint Base Andrews.
Couldn't hear you.
Will you send officials to Ukraine? Will you send senior officials to Ukraine?
Well, we're making that decision now.
Thank you.
Who would you send?
What was the reason?
Are you ready to go?
Are you?
Yeah.
President Biden at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland, getting on Air Force One. That question, are you ready to go, was directed back at the reporter who asked who he would send to Ukraine. On the plane flying down to North Carolina, a follow-up question by reporter to the Principal Deputy White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
To follow up what the president just said about making a decision on sending officials, on the discussions of who you may be sending, is it going to be a cabinet-level official, or what are we looking at?
And as he also, I'm just going to repeat what he said, is that we're still in discussion, deciding this. As you know, obviously, we're in contact with the Ukrainian government, with Kyiv, every day, pretty regularly. And so I just don't have anything to preview any further.
That's the Deputy White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre on Air Force One. During President Biden's trip to Europe last month, after that stop in Brussels for NATO and European Union meetings, he went to Poland, a country that borders Ukraine. While there, he said he would have liked to visit Ukraine on the trip, but the security concerns from the Secret Service and others made it impossible. The president saying, quote, "They will not let me, understandably, I guess, cross the border and take a look at what's going on in Ukraine." Today, his White House National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, speaking about that trip and the not going to Ukraine, and also reports of maybe instead sending a senior U.S. official.
The president visited Poland recently. And was there any thought to his going into Ukraine?
We did talk about it. I think the president would love the opportunity to go to Ukraine to show solidarity with the Ukrainians. The question of what kind of footprint that would require, what kind of assets that would take from the Ukrainians as well as from us, is a very serious one for him. So it was not under any serious planning that he would actually go to Ukraine on that trip.
There are reports today that a U.S. senior official will visit Ukraine. It was reported that maybe the Secretary of Defense or somebody like that. I assume you can't tell in advance, but can you suggest that maybe it would be a good idea if there were to be a senior official at some point, or you can't comment on that?
I can't. I'm not going to speak to any question about a senior official visiting Kyiv or visiting Ukraine at this point, because we want to make sure if and when that happens, and obviously, you know, Kyiv stands, we want to get Americans back there, but if and when that happens, we'll want to make sure it's done in a very secure way.
The White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan interviewed by David Rubenstein, president of the Economic Club of Washington, D.C. They were at a hotel in the nation's capital. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has encouraged world leaders to visit the capital city, Kyiv, to see firsthand the war damage from the Russian invasion and also show support for his nation. And last week, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson did just that, walking the street with Zelensky. An Associated Press article mid-afternoon on Thursday began the Russian military sustained a major blow Thursday when the flagship of the country's Black Sea Fleet was badly damaged and its crew evacuated. Ukrainian officials said their forces hit the vessel with missiles, while Russia acknowledged a fire aboard the Moskva, but no attack. The warship named for the Russian capital was 60 to 65 nautical miles south of Odessa when the fire ignited, and the vessel was still battling flames hours later when heading west, according to a Pentagon official. Well, late in the day, Russian state media TASS, quoting the defense ministry, saying that while being towed toward the destined port, the vessel lost its balance due to damage sustained in the hull as the fire broke out after ammunition exploded. Given the choppy seas, the vessel sank. Well, before it actually went down, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan asked about what this means.
So why don't we just start with the news from this morning. There's a report that a Russian ship was shot, abandoned, perhaps. What can you tell us about that?
So we've been in touch with the Ukrainians overnight who have said that they struck the ship with anti-ship missiles. We don't have the capacity at this point to independently verify that, but certainly the way that this unfolded, it's a big blow to Russia. This is their flagship, the Moscow, and they have now been forced to admit that it has been badly damaged, and they've had to kind of choose between two stories. One story is that it was just incompetence, and the other was that they came under attack, and neither is a particularly good outcome for them.
Would you expect, based on some of the cruise missiles or other armaments we've provided to the Ukrainians and that other allies have provided as well, that there will be more incidents like this where more ships will be damaged severely?
Well, without getting into sensitive operational issues, the president did go to NATO a few weeks ago and indicate to our allies that we are looking to facilitate the supply of coastal defense and anti-ship capabilities to the Ukrainians so that they can't be menaced from the sea. And that is being actively worked. I'll leave it at that.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan with the president of the Economic Club of Washington, David Rubenstein. Again, that was before the news coming out of Russian state media that that ship, that warship in the Black Sea, has been sunk. Earlier, Reuters reported that Ukraine's southern military command said it had hit that warship with a Ukrainian-made Neptune anti-ship missile. And Russia's defense ministry said that the sailors had contained a fire on board the cruiser and that measures were being taken to tow it back to port. The ministry said the blaze broke out after ammunition blew up on board. At the Pentagon, again, this was before the news had come about the damage and the actual sinking, and that's coming out of Russian state media. There's a question to the press secretary, John Kirby, not only about the status of the ship, but again, what does it mean? A question coming from Associated Press national security reporter Bob Burns.
Could you give your current assessment of the Russian ship incident as to whether it's your working assumption that it was struck by a missile? Is it still moving under its own power? And lastly, could you offer your assessment of what the significance of this loss is for the broader Russian campaign? Thank you.
So I'll just tell you what we know, and that's to be very honest with you, that we don't know everything. We cannot confirm the Ukrainian reports that it was hit by a missile, but we are also not in a position to refute that. That it could have been a Ukrainian missile which struck the ship. We just don't have perfect visibility on exactly what happened. We do believe that there was a significant explosion on this cruiser, the Moskva, of the Slava class of cruisers in the Russian Navy. We do believe that that explosion caused a significant fire, which as of this morning was still raging aboard the ship. We do assess that at least some of the crew members evacuated the ship and were placed aboard other Russian Navy ships. I can't tell you if it's the whole crew. We just have a sense, we have assessment that, some crew were evacuated from the ship. We are, this morning, we had assessed that the ship was underway under its own power. We are no longer able to make that certainty today, this afternoon. We're not exactly sure that the ship is actually still able to make its own way. So that's the update. That's the best that we can provide you in terms of what we know and feel comfortable speaking to. As for the impact on the Russian Navy, that's a little difficult to know with great certitude. They have and have had anywhere from a dozen to two dozen ships in, operating in the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov since the beginning of this invasion. They are they have ports, as you know, on the Black Sea, so they historically have operated there. It'd be difficult to be able to tell you that this one ship being out of commission, what exactly the impact's going to have. And the reason I say that is because their naval component here to the war has been fairly limited to two things. One, cruise missile strikes inside Ukraine, and two, replenishment and resupply of their efforts in the south. They've only conducted one amphibious landing, and that was on an uncontested stretch of beach near Berdansk in the Sea of Azov. And they hadn't really made any concerted naval efforts towards Odessa. So I guess it remains to be seen exactly what the major impact is going to be. Again, that said, this is a cruiser. They only have three in this class. It's a ship that is roughly 600 feet long. It has a crew of almost 400, more than 400, almost 500 sailors on board. And it's basically designed for air defense. That's what this ship is designed to do, not unlike our own cruisers. So it's going to have an impact on their capabilities, certainly in the near term. Whether it has an impact on their naval capabilities in the long term is just we're just unclear right now. And we don't have, as much as I know we'd like to have and you'd like us to have, we just don't have a better, clearer sense of the damage done and what impact it's going to have to the ship, the ship's future here in the near term, whether she can and will be repaired and put back into service or not. We just don't know.
That's the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby with reporters in the Pentagon briefing room at mid-afternoon on Thursday. Later on Thursday, the Russian state agency, media agency TASS, quoting the defense ministry, saying while being towed toward the destined port, that vessel lost its balance due to damage sustained in the hull as fire broke out after ammunition exploded. Given the choppy seas, the vessel sank. Russia warning Finland and Sweden that if they join NATO, Moscow will reinforce the Baltic Sea region, including by deploying nuclear weapons. Officials in Finland this week suggesting their country could request to join NATO's 30-member military alliance within weeks. Sweden is also considering it. Question about this at the State Department briefing to spokesman Ned Price.
Russia warned today that it would deploy nuclear weapons and hypersonic missiles in Kaliningrad if Finland and Sweden join NATO. Is the U.S. concerned about Russia upping its rhetoric around this? And then I have a question on embassy staffing as well.
The warning I saw in that regard came from a former Russian official who was no longer in power and arguably may not have been in power at the time he purportedly was in power. So no, we don't have a specific response to that. The Russian Federation knows where we stand in terms of our commitment to Article 5, the idea, the sacrosanct commitment we have that an attack on one is an attack on all, but we don't have a specific response to that.
State Department spokesman Ned Price. That official he's referring to is Dmitry Medvedev, former president of Russia between the terms of Vladimir Putin. Ukraine's prime minister meeting in Kyiv today with the chief prosecutor of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, and calling on that organization to investigate Russia's violations of international humanitarian law. Meanwhile, Russia's investigative committee saying that it's opening criminal cases into Ukrainian service personnel's alleged torture of their Russian counterparts. United Nations General Assembly and United Nations Security Council have met several times since the invasion of Ukraine began 2 months ago about that invasion. Some steps have been taken, such as a vote to remove Russia from the United Nations Human Rights Council. But in other cases, resolutions for the Security Council have not passed when Russia used its veto power. Today, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, was asked about criticism from Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, that the U.N. has not been effective in its response to Russian aggression.
The final question comes from Steve Brandt. He's the principal at TrimTad Management System. He says, based on President Zelensky declaring the World Peace Organization is obsolete in his speech to the U.S. Congress, do you support a design of a new peace process that eliminates the root cause of why we fight and offers a vision of a world beyond war to motivate that societal transformation?
You know, President Zelensky just didn't say that in front of the Congress. He said it to the Security Council when he spoke to the Security Council. And I certainly appreciate and understand his frustration. His country is being attacked. People are being killed. Cities are being demolished. Hospitals with children are being attacked. And he asked a question that none of us could have denied him, and that is, why has the UN not done more to stop this? We have done from the start. We have made every effort to isolate the Russians, to put pressure on the Russians, and to help the Russians find a diplomatic solution to have avoided this war. We have supported the Ukrainian government throughout this, both in terms of funding. I just heard as I was coming into this meeting that we had announced another nearly $1 billion of support for Ukraine. But the United Nations has to remain strong in calling out Russia and holding Russia accountable. It was not an easy task, suspending Russia from the Human Rights Council. So the United Nations and the member states have supported Ukraine, and we will continue to support Ukraine and do everything possible to bring this war to an end. We are supporting the Ukrainian prosecutors' efforts to gain evidence to bring against the Russians for war crimes. And we've called it war crimes, and we will do everything possible to hold the Russians accountable.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield, a virtual event hosted by the Brookings Institution. You can find it in its entirety at our video library at cspan.org. Story at National Review's website, a bipartisan delegation of U.S. lawmakers paid a surprise visit to Taiwan on Thursday night to reaffirm U.S. support for the island, drawing the ire of the Chinese Communist Party. The delegation includes Senators Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, Bob Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey and chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, Ben Sasse, Republican of Nebraska, Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, and Representative Ronnie Jackson, Republican of Texas, former advisor to President Donald Trump. The article goes on, the visit comes after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi canceled a planned trip to the island after contracting COVID. The Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Li had previously called Pelosi's planned visit a red line for U.S.-China relations. The delegation traveled on a U.S. Air Force jet, indicating the Biden administration had sanctioned the trip. They had previously been visiting Australia, talking about the AUKUS deal between the U.S. and U.K. and Australia about nuclear-powered attack submarines. Well, while in Australia, Senator Graham and Senator Menendez gave an interview to Sky News Australia talking about China. First, Senator Graham.
I wouldn't want to live in communist China. And communist China is using every lever it can to browbeat Australia. You decided to stand up to the Chinese Huawei system, which is basically, if you bought it, China would know everything about you, is our theory of the case. And you've paid a heavy price for standing up to China. And what I want to do is make sure that after this visit, you understand that we appreciate what you've done and we're more with you than ever. But Bob can explain, I think, as well as anybody in the United States Senate, the choice that people in the region of the world are going to make between China and the rest of us.
I'll let you jump off on that, Senator Menendez, but I guess it brings me to as well the Solomon Islands and this security deal between the Solomon Islands and China. We've got the Solomon Islands Prime Minister Sir Gavare saying it won't mean military bases, but haven't we seen that play out before?
Well, that's why President Biden sent his national security advisor for this region to have a conversation in the Solomon Islands, because I think it is both in the Solomon Islands' interest, Australia's interest, the United States, to ensure that there is not a Chinese base there, and to make sure that it is understood what it means to all of us. If that were the pathway forward, I take the word of its leader that says that's not the case. But, you know, at the end of the day, just to use your question to go to Lindsay's point, we do not seek conflict with China. We actually invited China into the international order in the expectations that it would ultimately engage in the international order in a way that would not create a Jeffersonian democracy, but would ultimately play by the rules of international engagement. China accepted the invitation, but they haven't played by the rules of international engagement. And so the question is not a question of choose the United States or Australia or China. The question is, what type of world do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a world that ultimately you are free to choose those who govern you? You are free to choose to worship as you that make an investment as a company. You have a reasonable expectation that it won't be perverse, that you ultimately have a set of level playing field. Or do you want to live in a world where ultimately you won't choose who governs you? You won't ultimately have a free economy. You won't ultimately be able to decide whether the rules of engagement are free and open, but actually coercive, as China is, as it's been to Australia when Australia stood up for its own sovereign interests. And so that's the choice that we ask people to make, not between the United States and China, but between what type of world you want to live in.
At Senator Robert Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, sitting for an interview along with Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, in Australia by Sky News Australia, before a surprise visit by the two and other U.S. lawmakers in the delegation to Taiwan. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman saying the Chinese side resolutely opposes any form of official exchange between the U.S. and Taiwan, and U.S. congressmen must also follow the U.S. government's One China policy. He also said China will take forceful measures to resolutely uphold Chinese sovereignty and territorial integrity. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. President Joe Biden visiting North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro today. WFMY-TV saying that he lauded the nation's largely historically black university on its efforts towards preparing students for jobs in STEM and clean energy. They go on that future includes companies that will bring thousands of clean energy jobs to the Greensboro area in the coming years. Boom Supersonic will make passenger jets, and Toyota will manufacture batteries for electric cars. They also write, Biden urged Congress to pass the Building a Better America bill during his speech, legislation aimed at building a supply chain in the United States.
Decades ago, we used to invest 2% of our gross domestic product in research and development. 2%. And we led the world. Today, we invest less than 1%. The United States of America used to be ranked number one in the world in investing in the future. Now we're ranked number nine in research and development. The United States of America. China was number eight 3 decades ago. Now it's number two. Other countries are closing in fast. We can and we must change that. Not by hurting other countries, but by developing ourselves. We have a great opportunity ahead of us with the Bipartisan Innovation Act I mentioned, which is going to provide $90 billion in research and development, STEM education, manufacturing, all those elements of the supply chain that we need to produce end products right here in America. If I told those of you who are closer to my age in the audience, if we told your parents that we'd be here, they'd look at it like we're crazy. What do you mean? We're the leader in the world. Not so. Congress needs to get this bill to my desk as quickly as possible. Our economic strength is on the line, and national security as well is on the line. Companies are ready to invest in America, in American communities, in American workers. But they need to see that their government is capable of investing in our future. Other countries are racing ahead, but we can't afford to wait. So Congress, get this bipartisan bill to my desk. North Carolina needs it. America needs it. And let's meet this moment together.
President Biden at the university in Greensboro, North Carolina. That bill is currently in a conference committee. The House passed one version. The Senate passed a different one. And the two sides need to work out a common bill that can pass both chambers to send to President Biden for his signature. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 113, NASDAQ down 292, S&P down 54. Labor Department says new unemployment insurance benefits applications rose last week after reaching the lowest level since 1968. Initial claims were 185,000, up 18,000 from the previous week. More than 90 federal agencies releasing today their equity action plans that were ordered by President Biden during his first days in office. Axios writes the Justice Department wants to help non-English speakers report crimes, and Defense Department is reviewing algorithmic bias in its artificial intelligence technology as part of the Biden administration's broad effort to tackle inequality. And from Associated Press, in just 10 days, Tesla CEO Elon Musk has gone from popular Twitter contributor to the company's largest individual shareholder to a would-be owner of the social platform, a whirlwind of activity that could change the service dramatically given Musk's self-identification as a free speech absolutist. Twitter revealed in a securities filing Thursday that the sometimes whimsical billionaire has offered to buy the company outright for more than $43 billion, saying the social media platform needs to be transformed as a private company in order to build trust with its users. That from AP. The Democratic National Committee moving a step closer to making the biggest change into its presidential primary calendar in years, writes NBC News, putting Iowa in jeopardy of losing its traditional first-in-the-nation spot. The DNC's powerful Rules and Bylaws Committee approved a plan that would let any state apply to be one of the coveted early states. One DNC delegate voted no, Scott Brennan from Iowa. He tells KCCI-TV in Iowa that now his state needs to make a good case to stay first.
We need to put on our best application. We need to showcase why the Iowa caucuses have been a great process for electing Democrats to the White House. Because ultimately, that's what this is. It's the presidential nominating process. It has nothing to do with anything else. It's about electing Democratic presidents. And again, you know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, we've won the popular vote the last four Democratic presidential cycles.
Brianne Fonensteel is chief political reporter with the Des Moines Register. She joins us now with more on the actions by the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee. Thanks for being with us. Give us the details. What was decided today?
So the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee is in charge of the presidential nominating calendar, so the order that states hold their primaries. And so the committee has a lot of power, especially over states like Iowa that have long held this preferred position at the front of the line. And so the committee voted this week to open up that process to allow any state that wants to be first or second, to be one of these early window states, to apply and to put their name in the ring. And they say that they're going to consider all of these applications. They're going to weigh which states make the best case, which states are best reflective of the values of the party today, and then make a decision. And so it could be the end of Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucuses. And immediately after that comes New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. All of those states will also have to reapply if they want to hold their positions.
You write in your article at the Des Moines Register website that the committee has made it clear during multiple public meetings that its focus is on dislodging Iowa from the leadoff spot. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think if you look at the actions this committee has taken over time, even going back to the 2016 election, they've made it pretty clear that they don't like caucuses. They prefer primaries. The caucuses are kind of a unique system, and they're more complicated. They require people to show up in person at a specific time and to spend sometimes hours at an event location to make their presidential preferences known. And they have some complicated rules about who wins and who gets awarded delegates at the end of it. When you look at a primary, it's much more straightforward. It looks like a normal election. You can stop by at any point in the day. You can cast your ballot and move on. It's much simpler. It's much clearer. It's easier to access for people who might need things like childcare, who maybe work the night shift, who don't have access to reliable transportation. So all of these things are kind of a factor when the DNC says that they would like to move toward primaries. And so they've made a series of changes over the years that have been designed to incentivize states to move toward a primary. And this feels like a much bigger push.
So what has been the reaction from those with a stake in the First in the Nation caucuses in Iowa?
Well, I think Iowa Democrats here and Republicans, too, frankly, are starting to feel it. They're very concerned about the way this could go. It does not look promising for Iowa to continue holding the first presidential preference contest. It really is looking like the DNC is committed to shaking this up, committed to maybe bringing in a different state into the process entirely. So, you know, the Iowa Democrats are kind of putting their resources together right now, putting their heads together, and they're going to try and come up with the best case that they can make to come to the DNC and say Iowa deserves to have a spot here, even if it's not the first state. Consider us to be one of the early states. So they'll be looking at ways that they can maybe make this caucus process more transparent, maybe make it run a little bit smoother, and see what they can do to convince the committee that they really do deserve this place.
We're talking with reporter Brianne Fonensteel. Why is being first or one of the first four important in the presidential primary and caucus process?
Well, being first is everything. You know, in Iowa, we're looking forward to the 2024 presidential election already, and we're seeing Republicans who might be wanting to run for president already coming to the state. They spend time here for, you know, a good year and a half, 2 years before that contest ever takes off. And so it's a really important thing that helps the state parties kind of organize, that helps local parties get energized. It gets the state a lot of attention. It's a lot of power, frankly, to get to have that first say. And so Iowa, you know, we say we don't pick presidents, but we winnow the field. And so Iowans have a chance to hear from everyone who wants to be president, see them in person, make a really informed choice about who they want to support. And then at the end, it narrows the field to who is viable enough to continue on beyond that. So being first is a huge, huge gift to the state that I don't think voters here take lightly. And being second in New Hampshire is also very, it's a powerful position as well, but there's nothing quite like being first.
Brianne Fonensteel is chief political reporter with the Des Moines Register. Find her stories at DesMoinesRegister.com and on Twitter at BrianneDMR. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
In New Hampshire, Senator Maggie Hassan, a Democrat, also promising her state will work to stay as the first presidential primary state. She tweeted, New Hampshire has held the first in the nation primary for over 100 years, and that's not going to change. We've defended our primary before, and we will do it again. The Republican National Committee today voting unanimously to withdraw its participation in the Commission on Presidential Debates, a nonprofit bipartisan commission that was set up in 1987. RNC Chair Ronna McDaniel in a statement saying the commission is biased and has refused to enact simple and common sense reforms to help ensure fair debates, including hosting debates before voting begins and selecting moderators who have never worked for candidates on the debate stage. Today is the 110th anniversary of the ocean liner RMS Titanic disaster. The ship hit an iceberg in the North Atlantic Ocean on its maiden voyage just before midnight, and it sank 2 hours and 40 minutes later on the 15th, killing over 1,500 passengers and crew. C-SPAN's American History TV visited a memorial to the victims of the Titanic. It's in Washington, D.C. The narrator of this piece is historian Richard Norton Smith.
This haunting likeness of a partly dressed man, likened by some to a soul departing the body, is the product of the Women's Titanic Memorial Association. Over 1,500 lives were lost when HMS Titanic went to the bottom of the North Atlantic after striking an iceberg on the night of April 14, 1912. Half the ship's female passengers perished, a number that would have been even higher but for hundreds of men who yielded seats in the doomed liner's woefully inadequate lifeboats. And that is why the Women's Titanic Memorial is explicitly dedicated to the men of the Titanic, over three-fourths of whom never reached New York. The 13-foot-high figure of sacrifice that towers over Washington's Channel Park is itself the creation of a female sculptor and patron of the arts. Ironically, Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney is probably less remembered today as the founder of New York's Whitney Museum of Art than she is for her leading role in the sensational 1934 child custody case involving her 10-year-old niece, Gloria. In a strange twist of fate, Mrs. Whitney lost her brother Alfred in another tragedy at sea when a German U-boat in May 1915 sank the passenger ship Lusitania off the coast of Ireland. 16 years later, Helen Taft, whose husband had been president at the time of the Titanic disaster, officially unveiled the cross-like Titanic Memorial located on Washington's Rock Creek Parkway. Carved from a single block of red granite, it is flanked by an elaborate stone bench, or exedra, attributed to Henry Bacon, designer of the Lincoln Memorial. In the mid-1960s, the memorial was moved from its original site to make way for the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Today it stands close to the waterfront in southwest Washington.
Historian Richard Norton Smith narrating that piece from C-SPAN's American History TV. You can find the video of it at our website, cspan.org. On this 110th anniversary of the Titanic hitting the iceberg. There's also another memorial in Washington, D.C. to the victims of the, from the Titanic, the Butt Millett Fountain on the Ellipse south of the White House. It's dedicated to the memory of Archibald Butt and Francis Millett. The National Park Service says they are believed to be the only officials of the United States who perished aboard the ship. Francis Millett served as vice chair of the Commission on Fine Arts. Archibald Butt served as a military aide to Presidents Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more top Washington stories sent to you every day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. You can sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.